Well, the parsha for this week is Kisavo. Before we actually involve ourselves in matters of the parsha, I wanted to devote some time to a topic of Inyana Diyoma, something which is of timely relevance, and that is with reference to the Slichos. As we know, from this Motzei Shabbos, we will be in Slichos. I say we, of course that means Ashkenazim. Sfardim have already been in Slichos since the beginning of Elul. Ashkenazim join a little bit later. Always the Motzei Shabbos, with at least 4 days between that and Rosh Hashanah. So this actually will be the longest amount of Slichos, because Rosh Hashanah is on a Tuesday. So we have all of next week, plus Sunday and Monday. And there is one section, I say one section, it's more than one section, but it's one of them is famous, and then we'll see its satellites and associates, that drew a lot of attention and was the focus of much discussion within the Slichos. The Slichos, as we know, takes the format, really, of Tfilah, in the sense that it starts with Ashrei, and then you have the Slichos, which are really like the Shmona Esrei. And then you have Tachnun after that, and Kaddish Tiskabel. So it's really like a Tfilah process in that way. And there are a number of things that we add in, Piyutim and Pizmonim, that we add in to the Tachnun. And among them is the section that begins, Machnisei Rachamim. Machnisei Rachamim, Hachnisu Rachameinu Lifnei Baal HaRachamim. And what translated, that means those who bring in Rachamim, petitions for mercy, bring in or enter in our petitions for mercy before the Merciful One. That is to say, we are addressing here the Malachim, whose job it is, or whose job we are assigning, to bring in our petitions for Rachamim. We're asking that they do that, Machnisei Tfilah, Mashmiei Tfilah, Machnisei Dima, etc. So the simple understanding of what is happening here is that we are addressing Malachim and asking them to help us bring our tefillahs before Hashem. Now, the place that everyone goes to at this stage is the Rambam. The Rambam, in his 13 Ikrim, the Rambam lays out what we know as the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith, in his introduction to his commentary on Perek Chelek, which is the 10th Perek, or 11th, of Sanhedrin, and that is where the Rambam has his full presentation of the 13 principles of faith as he formulates them. The fifth principle is about worshiping Hashem and no one else. Avoda is directed towards Hashem and no one else. And that's obviously an ikur within Judaism, a primary principle idea. But the Rambam says more than that. Firstly, says the Rambam, one should not worship any other entity other than Hashem. But secondly, and most significantly for us, because no one's worshipping the Malachim here, but the Rambam says further, then one should also not enlist any other entity as an intermediary towards worship of Hashem. And that second point, of course, will seemingly come into conflict with Machnisei Rachamim, because the Rambam is saying, do not petition or enlist any other force in your service of Hashem. Yet that seems to be exactly what we're doing, because we're petitioning the Malachim to bring our tfilos before Hashem. So this seems to be, and Slichos, if there's ever a time of the year when we want to be at our best and not doing anything that's objectionable, it's during Slichos when we're asking Hashem to forgive us. Yet this seems to be impeding or impinging, if not worse, on one of the principles of Emunah in terms of how to relate to Hashem with nothing else in between. How are we to understand this? And we should remember, I don't know if it's known exactly who wrote Machnisei Rachamim, but these are prayers that are in the Slichos already from the times of the early Rishonim. That means whoever wrote them are themselves Rishonim. There were those, indeed, based on this, who opposed the recitation of Machnisei Rachamim and stated that it should be removed and it shouldn't be said because it's very objectionable. So there were those who opposed, but of course, whoever wrote it did not oppose it and felt that it's acceptable. And in many communities, they say it. And how are we to understand why Machnisei Rachamim is an acceptable thing and a good thing, obviously, then to say? So the first thing we should note is that actually, with these words, at least at this stage, with these famous words, Machnisei Rachamim, Hachnisu Rachameinu, those who bring in mercy, bring in our petitions for mercy, we're actually not asking the Malachim to daven for us. Because what we're asking them to do is to take the tefillahs that we have offered and just to bring them to Hashem. And the background to this is as follows. The Gemara itself indicates, okay, so this is on the authority of the Gemara. This is in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Yud Beis Omid Beis. The Gemara states that Malachim are involved in the tefillah process. They are involved in the sense that it is Malachim that ferry a person's prayers up towards Hashem. And the way that it comes out from the Gemara, interestingly, is that it is there that the Gemara says a person should not pray in Aramaic. The reason why a person should not pray in Aramaic is because the Malachim do not relate to it. They don't recognize it. They won't ferry such a prayer up towards Hashem. Why will the Malachim not ferry a prayer that is offered in Aramaic towards Hashem? What is their issue with Aramaic? Well, the Rosh says that they consider Aramaic to be something that detracts from the honor of Lashon HaKodesh. It's almost like it's not exactly Lashon HaKodesh, and therefore, in principle, out of respect for Lashon HaKodesh, they will not accept to ferry a prayer up towards Hashem in Aramaic. That's very interesting for a number of reasons. But in terms of our discussion, it's interesting because we see that Malachim are involved in conveying our tefillos towards Hashem. Now, if that's true, if that happens, then it's possible to look differently at this Machnisei Rachamim. Because really what we're doing is we are exhorting the Malachim to do their job. It's something that the Malachim do. We're just further encouraging them. Our tefillahs, that it is your job to take them up towards Hashem, do so. And do your job well. And so it's really more in the realms of encouraging something that they are in any case doing, as opposed to asking them to do something that they wouldn't have done otherwise. In the same way, that a sentence just a bit further on, Machnisei Dima, Hachnisu Dimosenu, those that bring in the tears, bring our tears in towards Hashem. We're not asking the Malachim to cry for us. The crying is done by the Jewish people. We're asking the Malachim to take those tears and bring them up. So too, we're not asking them to daven for us as an intermediary. We're doing our own davening. We're just asking them and again encouraging them to bring those tefillos up. What's interesting is, and of course we are aware that there are some tefillos that we do say in Aramaic. And the reason why is because the Gemara says there in Shabbos that we only need Malachim to bring our tefillos up to Hashem if the Shechina is not abundantly present directly where we are. And what that means, for example, is that if a person is davening with a minyan, So then the Shekhinah is present in significant, in sufficient measure that we don't need malachim anymore. And you can daven in whatever language you want. That's why the prayers that we generally say in Aramaic are prayers that are said in shul, with a minyan, like Kaddish. Kaddish is in Aramaic. It's a tefillah. Yizkadal v'yizkadash shemerba. That's a tefillah. And Yukim Porokon and Brich Shemei, these things are said in shul. Interestingly, the reason why the Gemara comes to talk about this is within the context of Bikur Cholim. Because the Gemara says if you visit a sick person, and part of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim is to daven for the sick person. That's a very important part. Sometimes that kind of goes missing. Of course, the other parts are to see if they need anything and to encourage them and to give them moral support. But a core part of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim is to see them and to daven for them. The Ramban states explicitly that if a person would visit the sick but did not daven for them as a result of that, or in conjunction with that, the person has not fully fulfilled the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. Of course, one needs to act advisedly within the context of Bikur Cholim. If you see the cholim, you start breaking down into uncontrollable sobs, you might not do that much for his condition and good feeling. So one needs to use one's head. But either way, so the Gemara says, if when you visit a sick person, you can daven in Aramaic, which in the times of the Gemara was a very big concession, because that's the language people spoke. And the Gemara says, even though one shouldn't daven in Aramaic normally, but the Shekhinah is present by the head of someone who is sick, and therefore it's like being in shul. And you could daven directly. And certainly if you are in shul, if it's tefillah b'tzibur, so ironically, in shul, which is where most people say slichos, the malachim are not involved. So machnisei rachamim, which is telling the malachim that your job is to ferry tefillahs, that's if a person is davening by himself. But if he's with a minyan, malachim are out of the picture. So that's interesting that we say it in shul nonetheless. It could be that we're basically looking for all the help we can get, as if to say, we are betzibur, but if you're there and help bring our tefillos, etc. So this is, again, to put that into one sentence, so far, certainly no one's talking about davening to a malach. That's for sure not. And we're not even asking the malachim to daven for us. We're saying the malachim who convey the tefillos, please do that well and with alacrity and with energy and so on. And therefore, there's certainly room to understand why some would consider it not problematic at all to say that. They're doing it anyway. We're just telling them to do it. Having said that, there are those who objected, as we mentioned, and even this they would not allow. There should be no machnisei rachamim, and that's not appropriate to involve them or to address them even in any capacity when you're davening. That's really the point. Interestingly, one of those who was very vocal in his opposition of saying machnisei rachamim was the Maharal. Maharal in the Sefer Nesivos Olam, Nesiv HaAvodah, he says one cannot address the malachim at all. But what's very interesting is he didn't say that one should remove the prayer, but rather it should be amended, which clearly the Maharal felt was appropriate under the circumstances. We say machnisei rachamim hachnisu rachameinu with a hey. Hachnisu, which means we're addressing the malachim and telling them to bring the prayers to Hashem. Says Maharal, what would be better to say, and I'm not sure if the Maharal said this in his shul, but either way, he writes it, that it should be machnisei rachamim yachnisu rachameinu. Let the malachim yachnisu, we describe them in the third person plural. We're not addressing them. We're addressing the only one capital O that we ever addressed during tefillah, and that is Hashem. Part of our tefillah to Hashem is that he should allow the malachim who bring our tefillahs in, he should allow them in. So to Hashem we say that those machnisei rachamim yachnisu rachameinu, let them bring them in. I'm not sure how widespread the emendation of the Maharal became from Hachnisu to Yachnisu. Certainly nowadays, I don't know if it's said, maybe in Prague, I don't know. But that was the, in principle, therefore, Maharal's position is clear. He just didn't want to throw out the tefillah, and therefore he amended hachnisu tiachnisu. So thus far, we have navigated around machnisei rachamim because we're not doing anything other than to tell them to do what they're doing anyway. However, there are other places in slichos, actual slichos themselves, where we do address the malachim and we do ask them to daven for us. On the second day of slichos, there's always a pismon towards the end. And the pismon for the second day is called Malachi Rachamim, Angels of Mercy. And the first two lines are Malachi Rachamim, Misharsei Elyon, Angels of Mercy, those who administer on high, Chaluna Pnei Kael. Chaluna means entreat, please, Pnei Kael. Chaluna like Vayichal Moshe. So we're asking the Malachim to entreat Hashem on our behalf. B'meitav higayon, that's Mishar Se Elyon, B'meitav higayon, that's the with eloquent expression. So this is already much closer, seemingly, to a problematic area, because we're no longer just telling them to ferry our tefillahs, we're actually asking them to daven on our behalf, to petition Hashem on our behalf. And the truth is that even in the Machnisei Rachamim, which we seemingly dealt with, it starts by asking them to ferry our tefillahs, but a few lines in, we say, Hishtadlu v'harbu tchina u'bakasha, please exert yourselves and engage in abundant petition and request. That's tefillah. We're asking them to daven. So even Machnisei Rachamim turns into, halfway through, us asking them to daven. And how is that not problematic in terms of having an angel as an intermediary for you? We're asking the Amalachim to intercede on our behalf. Now here too, again, to be clear, no one is davening to the Malachim. We're not asking the Malachim not for a good year. We're not asking them to forgive us, or anything like that. But we are asking them to ask Hashem. And as per the Rambam, that is already a problematic thing to do. Because, again, to review, the Rambam says in his fifth Ikar, not only that one should only worship Hashem alone, but also not enlist any malachim in the worship of Hashem. And that seems to be what we're doing. How can that be justified? Now, one could say it's entirely possible that these Rishonim, again, the Rishonim who composed these slichos, malachi rachamim, etc., perhaps they did not agree with the Rambam in that point. As if to say, all agree that the focus of worship, the ultimate object of, or subject of worship, is Hashem. That's true. But the Rambam's follow-up point, or second point, that you can't enlist a malach and ask him to daven on your behalf to Hashem, maybe these Rishonim felt that's not a problem. Because at the end of the day, the only one that's being davened to is Hashem. What difference does it make who's doing the davening? So perhaps they simply do not feel that's a problem. That's not in violation of this Ikur of Emunah. And the truth of the matter is that some Rishonim even raised the question, why would we say that it's objectionable to ask an angel to daven for you, but it's not objectionable to go and ask a tzaddik to daven for you? What is the difference between them? In both cases, you're not davening to the angel and you're not davening to the tzaddik. You are enlisting their help to daven for you. So, and surely as everyone agrees, and this is a time-honored pursuit, and the Gemara discusses this type of thing, the Gemara says in Bava Basra, Kuftet Zayin, if a person has someone unwell in their house, they should go to a chacham to daven for them. So the idea of asking someone to daven for you, if it's a person, is acceptable, because the focus of the tefillah, the recipient ultimately, is Hashem. What difference does it make, again, if you are between asking a tzaddik to daven for you and an angel to daven for you? And maybe therefore they felt that they're all the same and it's all acceptable. Now, interestingly, This question actually was addressed head on by one of those who opposed Machnisei Rachamim, and that is the Mabit, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Yosef Mitrani, who lived in Tzfat together with Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was a member of his Bezdin. And the Mabit said, there's a difference, it's a very basic question. There's a difference between asking a tzaddik to daven for you and asking an angel to daven for you. What is the difference? The difference, says the Mabit, is, and the Levush says likewise, Reb Mordechai Yaffe and the Levush, that when it comes to asking a person to daven for you, there is no notion, there's no worry for any type of misunderstanding that you're deifying the person because he's a person. He's a human being. Flesh and blood. So it is manifestly obvious that if you're asking him to daven for you, it's never that he becomes the one who's worshipped, but only helping you in your own tefillah. Which is not the case with an angel, because an angel is a spiritual being and an angel is a heavenly force. And there it's much more problematic because you're one step away, or it's not entirely clear between asking this heavenly force to daven for you and petitioning the heavenly force itself. That's why to ask a tzaddik to daven for you is acceptable and encouraged, and to ask a malach to daven for you is unacceptable. Even there, it sounds like from the Mabit that it's almost like the fear of misunderstanding, that it could be misconstrued if you ask a malach to daven for you. It doesn't sound like it's inherently objectionable. It's no different than a tzaddik. It's just you're asking for trouble. Well, again, maybe these other Rishonim do not subscribe to this distinction. As far as they're concerned, you can ask a tzaddik to daven for you, you can ask malachim to daven for you, and then compose these tefillos. But I think there's room to say, and if I understood correctly, Rav Asher Weiss is also heading in this direction, that it could be even the Rambam would not have an issue with asking malachim to daven for you. Notwithstanding the way he is quoted, that you cannot use malachim as an intermediary. And the reason why is as follows. We have stated very generally that the Rambam says you can't daven to a malach, and you can't ask a malach to daven for you. Actually, the Lashon of the Rambam, of course, it will always be translated into Lashon HaKodesh, but the substance we assume is exactly that, is as follows. Hayesod HaChamishi, just to read two or three lines from the Rambam to get a sense of exactly where the problem would lie. Number one. Shehu Yisbarach, Hu Haro'i La'ovdo U'Lagadlo. Only Hashem is appropriate to worship him and to aggrandize him. U'Lahudia G'duloso, to tell of his greatness. V'la'asos mitzvosav, and to do his mitzvos. V'lo yasu kazeh, and not to do anything like that, lemishu tachtav b'metzius, any other level of existence that is under Hashem, which is everything else. Min hamalachim, kochavim, galgalim, and everything else. So that's pretty clear. The only one that we have a deity relationship with is Hashem. And then says the Rambam, and let's hear these words carefully, v'chein ein ra'oi le'avdam. It is similarly not correct to worship them, meaning these other entities, kidei lehiyosam emtsaim lekarva elav, in order for them to serve as intermediaries, as medium, to bring us closer to Hashem. Those are the critical words, and I'll read them again. V'chein ein ro'i le'avdam. It is not correct to serve these other entities, kidei lihiyosam emtsaim lekarva elav, so that they would serve as intermediaries or mediums to bring us closer to Hashem. In other words, what the Rambam is saying is an angel can never be the object of worship, not directly for himself, and also you cannot worship an angel in order somehow that should bring you closer to Hashem. That you can't do. You can't have an avodah relationship, a worship relationship, with anything other than Hashem. Even if the goal is that you bring you closer to Hashem. That's very different to what we're doing. We're not worshipping malachim at all, even as we ask them to daven for us. That's not saying if we worship them, maybe they'll help us. There is no avoda of malachim happening here. And from the close reading of the Rambam, it's possible that even the Rambam wouldn't find that objectionable. Interestingly, the 13 principles of the Rambam have been transposed and formatted into what we call the Animamins, which are printed in the Siddur at the end of Shachris. It is a whole area of study to see to what degree do those Animamins represent and capture exactly what the Rambam is saying as he said it. And sometimes there can be differences that can make a difference. For our purposes, I don't know that it makes such a difference, but it's worthwhile noting that the Rambam in his own words, that is to say, in his commentary to the Mishnah, in his introduction to Chelek, he spoke about the fact that only Hashem is the subject of Avoda, and Malachim can never be the subject of Avoda. And Avoda will translate as divine service or divine worship. For those who know the Animamins, it actually formats it quite differently, or significantly differently. Because it says in number 5, Animamin b'munah shaleima, with complete faith, Shahabari Yisbar Shemo, that the Creator, lo, with a vav, lo, to him, levado, ra'oi lehit palel, it is correct to daven only to him, lehit palel, ve'ein ra'oi lehit palel lezulasso. It is not correct to daven to anyone else. So the Rambam spoke about avoda, the Animamin speaks about tefillah. One could say that ultimately they're very, very similar, perhaps the same, because tefillah itself is a form of avoda. But the Rambam wasn't only talking about tefillah. The Rambam was talking about the entire aspect of avoda relationship. And this then is, if it's clear what we're suggesting, that what the Rambam outlaws is serving a malach to bring you closer to Hashem. But asking a malach to daven for you, you can ask anyone to daven for you. A tzaddik, and also a malach. And it could be that this pismon, where we ask the malachim to daven, it's very interesting that we preface by calling them mishar se elyon. Malachei rachamim, angels of mercy, mishar se elyon. We preface by calling them servants so that there should be no misunderstanding that we are not petitioning them and we are not relating to them as an object of worship, because they're misharsim. That's all they are. In that capacity, we are asking them to daven for us. And that's how those malachim clearly felt was acceptable. And as we say, perhaps, although that's not the popular notion, perhaps even the Rambam would agree in that regard. The truth is that there is the final step where we seem to be addressing the malachim directly doesn't exist within the slichos, but actually throughout the year. Every Friday night, when we come home, we say Shalom Aleichem and to the malachim, and then Boachem L'Shalom. And then we say, Barchuni l'shalom. Barchuni l'shalom. Malachei Hashalom. Bless us in peace. So we are actually addressing the malachim directly and asking them for a bracha. That seems to be much closer to the problematic area than anything we've said so far. We're not asking them to ferry a tefillah. We're not asking them to daven for us. We are asking them for a bracha. It is noted that Reb Chaim Volozhin, and there's some, I perhaps still have this minhag, Reb Chaim Volozhin did not say the stanza of Barchuni L'Shalom, because you do not wish to ask a malach for a bracha. And yet, here too, for those many Jews, probably most Jews who say Shalom Aleichem, also say Barchuni L'Shalom, but we need to understand, and again, this is Reb Asher Weiss says, that when you ask someone for a bracha, you really, in essence, you're really asking them to daven for you. After all, what is a bracha? When you ask someone for a bracha, you're not saying that you are the source of what I'm asking for. You can directly provide what it is. What we are saying is you can bless me, and in that way, that power of your blessing will bring Hashem to give it to me. A bracha, in a sense, as much as you're addressing the recipient of the bracha, but it's effectively an implicit prayer. Many brachas are explicitly like that. Birchas Kohanim. The Kohanim are blessing the people. But what are they saying? It's black and white. Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha. Yo'er Hashem panav eilecha v'chunecha. It's all about the one who's giving the bracha is saying, this is what Hashem should do for you. So all I'm doing effectively is bestowing my wish that that should be. More than that, I can't do. And once again, it's no different, one could argue, than asking a tzaddik for a bracha. If you ask a tzaddik for a bracha, you're not davening to the tzaddik, but you're asking that the tzaddik should bestow his wish, and Hashem should respond to his wish. And the truth is that this is something that one could say goes back even further. Any child already knows the pasuk Hamalach Hagoel Osi Mikara Yivarech Es Hanarim. Yaakov said that. That the malach should bless the children. But what does that mean? The malach is not the source of the blessing, but the malach should bestow his blessing so that Hashem will bring it about. So it's very interesting. The magnet for this discussion is Machnisei Rachamim, but the truth is that it's something that is an issue on a weekly basis, and depending on what you say every day, perhaps even on a daily basis. These are the highlights of the arguments for and against Machnisei Rachamim. And therefore, one should, as we know, as we effectively described, we didn't mention all the names, but it's a generations-long dispute, centuries-long dispute, really. There were those who endorsed saying these sections. There were those who had issues with it and felt that it should not be said. And that's how it remained. Interestingly, there was a certain point in history where everybody came together to defend the practice, even people that didn't approve of it. And that took place in Germany in the 1800s. Reform was had ascended, and they were doing whatever they wanted to do with the tefillah. Anything that did not suit their Teutonic tastes was taken out, whether it's Karbonos, Geula, or Return to Israel, or anything like that. And one of the things that they just discarded was Machnisei Rachamim. They didn't know what to do with it. Talking to angels, they have a hard enough time talking to God. Angels are just going to complicate things. And therefore, they felt that that was not appropriate, and they made a move to remove it. Once that happened, so then the Orthodox response, the dynamic changes now. Because it's no longer an internal machlokas, beinenu levein atzmenu, that we have the luxury of everyone wants to keep mitzvahs as best they can. What's the best way to do that? But these people are not interested in keeping mitzvahs, and they have taken out Machnisei Rachamim. At that point, the Orthodox response was more or less unanimous to keep it in as a response to just the cavalier removal of Machnisei Rachamim. And thus, ironically, Reform brought shalom to the Frumo Olam, which I guess is sometimes that happens. And this remained true, or this was also true in England, where Reform was also making inroads, and there was an overt move to remove Machnisei Rachamim. And one of those who was involved in the battle, this is the late 1800s, whenever it was actually the son-in-law of Rav Hirsch, who lived in England at the time. His name was Rav Michael Levy. And he wrote to his father-in-law, Reb Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, what should we do? Is it acceptable? Is it not acceptable? And Reb Shimshon Rafael Hirsch wrote back a letter and says, keep it in. Exclaiming within his letter, what difference does it make if you ask a tzaddik to daven for you, or if you ask an angel to daven for you? Which is really echoing something that had been said for all those generations. And so it's very interesting that the whole forces at play kind of changed a little bit. And the way that it remains is that it's, I don't think there's a, I don't know if there's a slichus that doesn't have it in. And people act as they see, feel is correct. And I think most people say it. And there are some people that don't say it. The Chasam Sofer, who of course was a defender of Minhagim in there in the 1800s. So he wrote a tshuva about it, and he says it should certainly not be removed from the Siddur. And as for his own personal practice, he had his reservations, but he had a different way of navigating the issue. He would just basically take a very long time over the earlier parts of Tachlin, so by the time he got there, the Chazm was already finishing, and they didn't have time to say it. So if that's a mahalach, if anyone wishes to follow the practice of the Chasam Sofer, but certainly there is enough basis. I think we've reached a stage where we understand where both sides are coming from, and that, of course, is always important, certainly to make shalom conceptually between the two. In closing, I think it's also fair to mention that there is another force that has allowed for the further acceptance of Machnisei Rachamim, and that is, it's a very popular song. It's a very stirring song, Machnisei Rachamim. And what that means is, even people who have an objection to saying it in shul might not have all of their objections assembled if they're just around the table and singing. And therefore it gains entry in that way through the medium of song. And then nature imitates art, because a person is in shul and he comes to Machnisei Rachamim, and he may be vaguely mindful of the fact that some people have an objection to it, and he's saying, well, if I just sang it five times in Shal Shudders, why would I not say it just the one time in Shul? And thus, that's another force which also needs to be reckoned with. So these are some of the pertinent ha'aras with Machnisei Rachamim. There's much, much more to say, but for our purposes, something to be aware of. The main thing is all the slichos should be said with kavana, and everyone's heart should be in it. They should all ascend to the same place, however they're meant to ascend to that place, and they should be answered by the only one who can answer them, Kodesh Baruch. So, having discussed an extra parsha matter, let us now open the parsha. And the parsha begins, of course, with Bikurim. V'lokachta mereshis pri ha'adama. And I came across a very wonderful idea in the Sefer of Rav Baruch Rosenblum, Shalita of Bnei Brak, and he notes the following. As we know, the Bikurim come specifically from the Shivas Haminim. That is to say, from the seven species, Chito, Seora, etc. They don't come from other fruits. One could bring other fruits actually as what's called iture bikurim, as adornments, but they're not really the mitzvah. We've mentioned in the past a very beautiful idea, it's from the Arizal, that bikurim actually comes as a rectification for the sin of the meraglim. The meraglim use the fruits of Eretz Yisrael to denigrate the land. And therefore we come and specifically bring the fruits of Eretz Yisrael in order to speak in praise of the land. Two of the Shivas Haminim, as we know, and we know what the seven are, and two of them are grapes and olives. Now, what's interesting is grapes and olives, as part of the Shivas Haminim, so they accrue to a number of mitzvahs. They'll be included in the mitzvah of Bikurim. They'll also, as we know, are included in the mitzvah of Truma. Reishis degoncha tirosh chavi yitzarecha. Tirosh is wine. Yitzhar is oil. Wine from grapes, oil from olives. So truma, as explicitly mentioned in the pasuk, also is from olives and grapes. What is the difference between them? The difference between them is that when it comes to truma, as the pasuk says, you take truma from oil and from wine. What that means is that you don't give the grapes as truma. I mean, you could, but clearly the way that it's meant to be done is don't give the grapes as truma. Turn the grapes into wine. Give the wine as truma. Don't give the olives as truma. Turn it into oil and give the oil as truma. Should be tirosh v'yitzhar. Now, that is not true with regards to Bikurim. When Bikurim come from grapes and olives, you bring the grapes and olives, you don't bring wine and oil. And that's an interesting shaila, because of course the two mitzvahs seemingly are so close to each other, but in this regard, they divide. What do we do with the grapes and the olives, if anything, before you do the mitzvah with them, and why is it different? So Rav Rosenblum says like this, the difference between them is that truma is something that is basically given to the Kohen. It's given as an expression of, in order to help the Kohen and to contribute to the service of the Kohen on high. So truma, in a sense, is something that you're giving back to Hashem. In terms of giving something back to Hashem, and as we actually discussed in an earlier parsha, the way truma works, according to some, is that you actually give it to Hashem and he gives it to the Kohen. Either way, obviously, if you want to give something back to Hashem, you'll do so in the most enhanced possible way. You'll continue the process. You'll take the grapes, but you'll make them into wine. You'll take the olives, but you'll make them into oil, and therefore develop the finest product. And it's worth waiting, because that final product is the optimum, and that's what you give to the Kohen. Bikurim is different. The goal of Bikurim is to express Hakaras Hatov. When we bring Bikurim, as Rashi himself says, as soon as you start to talk, you say, I'm saying I've come to the land that Hashem has given me, Rashi says, to tell you that I am not ungrateful. I recognize Hashem has brought us to the land. He's given us the produce as represented by these seven species. The bringing of Bikurim is an expression of Hakaras Hatov. So what's the moral of the story? When it comes to Hakaras Hatov, as soon as you have the item that you've received, it's already time to say thank you. You could do something with it. You could develop it. But the notion that, you know, I've got the raw materials, I've got the basic, I've got the grapes and the olives, but I'm not going to say thank you yet, because there's still a way to go with them. I could turn this into wine. I could turn this into oil. And the Torah says, when it comes to thank you, you don't wait. You've already received what they say thank you. When you turn it into wine, it can say thank you again. And if you turn the olives into oil, it can say thank you again. But thank you doesn't wait. It's time stamped in real time. And what's very interesting is this idea parallels a comment of Rav Soloveitchik with regards to Seder night. On Seder night, we say, we have the song of Dayenu, and we go through 15 stages, and we say, if Hashem had done this and not done this, Dayenu, it would have been enough. As we know, Ilo Tzionim Mitzrayim, if he did so, we keep on going through the stages. Now, some of the stages are actually very difficult to know how they even represent stages in themselves. If he split the sea, but hadn't brought us in. So what happened? Nothing's happened yet. But it's not true that nothing's happened. In terms of our historical experience, you could say, it isn't over until we're safely installed in the land of Israel. But there's so many stages on the way. And for each stage, we stop and we say, Dayenu, something has happened. It's not over, but it started. There's many more stages to go, but here's another stage that's happened. Even in stages of a process, with each stage, we say, Dayenu, that would be sufficient for us to say thank you. If there's more coming, fantastic. We're looking forward, and we'll say thank you again, but we don't wait. And in fact, there's a further one could say, a deeper nekuda here. Because Hakaras Hatov, appreciation and recognition of the kindness that Hashem does, that itself is an activating force for more kindness to happen. When we recognize, so then we energize. And that itself is a catalyst for more. So on the contrary, you're at stage 3 of a 15-stage process in the Dayenu. And you'll say, well, there's so many more stages to go. Help them happen. Say thank you. Prove yourself worthy. At least worthy as a recipient. So these are, that is a lesson that goes now off the page from the Chumash in Bikurim. It's true for every time a person is a recipient of kindness. There can always be more. What else? But something's happened. Dayenu says, Bikurim says, don't wait for the grapes to become wine before you say thank you. So it's a very wonderful idea. I'd like to move from here actually to the Haftorah. We're in the Haftorahs of the Shivat and Nechemta, the seven Haftorahs of comfort. And each one is just more wonderful than the next. The Haftorah of Kisavo, Kumi Ori, Kiva Oreich. It's of the longer of the Haftorahs. And I want to focus on the end, the final pasuk, which I think is actually quite well known. Perhaps the final two words, very well known. Hakaton Yele Elef. The small will increase a thousandfold. Vatsair Lugoyatsum. And the young will be a great nation. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem, be'ito achishena. In its time, I will hasten it. In its time, meaning the time of the Geula, I will hasten it. There is a very famous discussion of the Gemara here, but it's in Sanhedrin, Perek Chelek. It's all about Mashiach and many other things. I think of the Daf Tzadik Tes, or Tzadiches. Be'ito achishena, the Gemara perceives a contradiction between these two terms, when you think about it, because be'ita means in its time. Achishena means, lehachish means to speed something up, which means to bring it early. But if it's early, then it's not in its time. And if it's time, it's not early. How can be'ita and achishena live together? And the Gemara famously answers that they can't. Because these two terms, be'ita and achishena, in its time and hastened, actually reflect two alternative possibilities for when the ge'ula will come. It could come be'ita, at the preordained final time, but it could also come earlier, achishena. What does it depend on? Says the Gemara, depends on the Jewish people. Zochu, if they have sufficient merit, achishena. Then I'll hasten it. They can bring the ge'ula early. Lo zachu, if they didn't merit, so then it will happen, but it won't happen before the preordained final time. So that is the Gemara's understanding of these two terms, bi'ita, achishena, two alternatives. The ge'ula can be brought early through zuchus. And this idea led many to ask a simple question, a simple but truthful question. And that is, what does the generation meriting look like? And the background to the question is, we have a notion, and it's not really hard to understand why, that in spiritual terms, there's something of a decline of the generations. You think back to the times of the Vilna Gaon and Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and you don't even want to go further back than that. And these are mighty generations, full of merit, more than us, we assume. And Mashiach didn't come for them. And we're told, you know, any generation can merit it, but what does that mean? The simple equation, if the generation with more merit didn't bring the Mashiach, how will the generation with less merit bring the Mashiach? So how does it work? This question is actually addressed by the Chofetz Chaim in one of his Sfarim. I mean, it's very easy to lose count of how many Sfarim the Chofetz Chaim wrote. And many of them are life's works. And there's a lot of them. But one of the Sfarim that he wrote was called Machane Yisrael. Machane Yisrael was written for Jewish soldiers that were conscripted into the Tsar's army to help them keep halacha and to help them stay Jewish as best they could in the army. And within the context of that sefer, he discusses this matter. And he says a big chiddush, and he's not the only one who says it. If I remember correctly, I heard from my father, Zatzal the Shem Yishmul of Sokotchov, likewise has this idea. And that is the idea of the merit that's required to bring the Mashiach is not assessed with each generation by itself. It is a cumulative process. It is the result of the efforts of all the generations. Which means it may well be that the early generations had more merit, And each subsequent generation adds less merit, but it's merit on top of that of the earlier generations, which is an amazing thing. Because here is the Chofetz Chaim, and we look upon the Chofetz Chaim as someone, well, how could it work for us if it didn't work for him? But he's addressing people who are thinking the very same thing in his time. And he's talking to these soldiers, and he's encouraging them, and he's saying, we don't know just how much more we need, but it's cumulative. It's accrual. And each generation could be the one that just brings it over that point and finish the process, the generation-long process of merit. That was the answer of the Chofetz Chaim, which is a very wonderful thing to consider. It's also interesting that we don't seemingly, happily, look at demerit as a cumulative thing. Because then that would set things back. I hope not. But the focus is much more on all of the merits that people do. And even a lesser, it's the proverbial, the ant on top on the shoulder of the giant. Much, much smaller, but that much higher. This question actually was also addressed by the Arizal. In fact, it's recorded as a conversation that he had with his Talmud, Rabbi Chaim Vital. And again, when we hear what he says, and he says this in Sfat in the 1500s, and then we fast forward to the 21st century, everything is obviously relative. But Rabbi Chaim, the Arizal said to Rabbi Chaim Vital that you should know that when we talk about merit, it's not about amounts of things done. I mean, it obviously includes that. But the way of assessing a merit is qualitative. How much needs to be overcome in order to do that good deed? The more opposition there is to good, the greater is the achievement of every good deed done. And the greater is the merit, qualitatively. And again, for us, it's hard to imagine. In the 1500s, he's saying the forces of evil are so prevalent and dominant nowadays, every good deed, even if it's lesser quantitatively or pound for pound, but it could be an equal, if not greater, merit than that of the big merits of the earlier generations. Every generation really can, by itself, merit to bring the gula. And even as we say, but our powers are diminished and so on and so forth, that may well be. But with those diminished powers, to endeavor to do the right thing, who knows how much every good deed of such a climate is rated vis-a-vis the otherwise greater deeds of the earlier generations. So these are wonderful ideas, I think, to bear in mind as we connect with what the Gemara says, that it's possible for each generation to bring the Geula. That's the enduring message, as far as the Gemara is concerned, of our Haftarah. Be'ita and Achishena. Thus far as the Gemara is concerned. But interestingly, while the Gemara saw something of a tension or conflict between these two terms for reasons that we said, in its time and hasten can't live together. But there are Mefarshim, Rishonim, who understand that they can live together. Because one is talking about the time of the Geula, and the other is talking about the process of the Geula. And these are really two separate questions. The Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, Rabbeinu David Kimchi, in his commentary on Yeshaya, explains that be'ita, when the time for Geula comes, and it's finally here, but there's a process that needs to lead to it, that process will be achishena. That process will be sped up. It will be expedited. And interestingly, some say that this duality of when is the right time and how quickly the process will then follow on from there is something that we refer to regularly. It's in the Kaddish, because we say that Hashem's kingship should be Yisgadal v'Yisgadash Shemerba, Ba'agala uvizman kariv. Ba'agala uvizman kariv, which means soon and shortly. Why is that not a redundancy? I mean, there's two ways of saying soon and shortly. But the Vilna Gaon says, no, Ba'agala means that the Geula should happen soon, and Bizman Kariv means that all of the stages of Geula should then happen quickly. Because some of the stages of Geula are, we do not wish for them to be protracted. They're not always easy. They're the birth pangs of Mashiach. And that's Be'ita Achishena. And every generation, again, it surveys the scene around it. We like to think that we're close to the Geula, but we're in a process. And not every stage of the process is easy. And very often there are moments or days or in each particular stage which are difficult to understand and to comprehend and to appreciate how all of this is part of the process. It's very difficult in the present. We say in the future we'll look back, so that's really the tefillah. Bring us to the future so that we'll be able already to look back, and we shouldn't have that much of these things to look back on. It's very interesting that the mitzvah of Bikurim, when a person brings their fruits, they actually go over the whole history of the Jewish people from the beginning, that this is the source of Aramiya Vedavi, Vayered Mitzrayim. We start literally from the beginning with Yaakov and Lavan and Mitzrayim, and what's that got to do with anything? You want to say thank you for your fruits, so say thanks for the fruits. What's with the whole history and with Lavan and Yaakov? I mean, this is really starting from way back when. But then the idea is that the Jewish people themselves, what becomes of them as a result of the process, and not every part of that process is easy for them. And it's hard at the time to appreciate how this is of benefit. But when you look back and you see where you are, you're finally able to get something of a window into the contribution of those stages, difficult as they were at the time. And when is the time to appreciate every stage in a process? When you finished your own process. You just brought Bikurim. That's a lot. That's the whole year. And not every stage you see a fruit. It doesn't start to bud until the end. But all that has to go into it, and all the digging and everything else. But you understand that those are all parts of a process. What better time to connect experientially with the importance of every stage in a process, then we ourselves have just finished a process, and we look back and we say, well, we were like that. We started underground. We started buried in Mitzrayim. Vayered Mitzrayim, with all those difficulties or whatever, each in its own way, as the Torah refers to it, as the refining furnace, it made the Jewish people as they are today. At the time, hard to see. Looking back, easier to see. We're waiting for the time that we can look back and that it's easy to see. And Be'ita, we want Be'ita to happen, and then Achishena to happen. And all of the Nechamas that are mentioned in the Haftarahs, we should experience them soon. Ba'agala uvizman karif.